Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Audrey Golden, station manager, writer, and host of the weekly show Breaking Glass. And we're talking about her new book, I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women at Factory Records. Audrey, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks so much for having me.
I got to ask you, what brought you to write this book?
Well, you know, my interest in factory records actually started in the 90s and through a kind of funny source, I guess. I discovered Joy Division through the soundtrack of The Crow.
Oh, great.
And the Nine Inch Nails cover of Dead Souls. So my love of factory really started there. And I came to it as a fan first. And then when I got a little bit older and was able to buy some of the ephemera, especially some of the Christmas cards, I started to realize that there were a lot of women's names written just on all of these materials, and yet none of these women's names appeared on any of the things I'd read about factory records. And so I started to track a few of them down. And at first I thought, you know, maybe this will be an article, maybe something, you know, a little bit shorter along those lines. And as I really started to realize just how critical the women were to factory and just how many of them there were whose stories hadn't been told, I really knew it had to become a book.
It's absolutely amazing to me as a huge fan of factory records. Women, after reading your book, were literally written out of the history of both the Hacienda and factory records. And we should just pause for a moment for people who are too young to remember. Factory Records was the record company that that released people like New Order, Joy Division, A Certain Ratio, The Happy Mondays, and the list goes on. The Hacienda was their huge club. And there have been movies and there have been many books written about both of these things. And the women that are in your book are just not major players, but after reading your book, neither of these things could have existed without women.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. I mean, it's incredible the way their stories are either just written out altogether or completely marginalized from any of those existing histories when they really were so critical to everything, and not just to making these things run and ensuring that they function, but also to a lot of the creative power of factory.
Right. It's amazing. And if people have seen the movie 24-Hour Party People, which is about factory records and the Hacienda, women are like a minor player in that movie. And as several of the people you interview for this book, the books have gotten it wrong. Like Hook got it has in several instances just got everything completely wrong. I think it was Tracy Donnelly in your book said women were the backbone of everything. And yet all the histories they've been written out of. Now, this book is different because it is sections of numerous interviews that you did. Talk to me about how you organized this.
Yeah, I mean, so I knew from the start I wanted this to be an oral history because to me the oral history form is a form that really highlights the voices of the people who were there, the storytellers. And so I knew just by virtue of the fact that these women's voices had been just so excluded that this needed to be an oral history, but it also to me is a really democratic form of storytelling where no voices are really subordinate to others. And so in that way too, it kind of pushed back against the existing histories of factory. So that's the oral history form part of it. And then I also really wanted to push back against the kind of chronological structure of the stories that have been told to date, because to me, that chronological structure gets into this realm of the so-called definitive history. And anytime you call something definitive, there's a suggestion that you're getting the whole story. And it sort of becomes then a self-fulfilling prophecy. People come to believe they are, in fact, you know, reading the definitive thing, and there's nothing else that needs to be known. And that couldn't be more wrong in most cases, actually, but especially in the case of factory records. None of the existing histories to date are definitive by, you know, any stretch, because they excluded so many of the stories of the women who did so many different types of work for and around the label. So I wanted to organize it in a way that sort of pushed back against that that so-called definitive chronology. And so I organized it thematically and, you know, pieced together the materials into these thematic chapters that you have in the book. And it's funny, you know, talking to some people who have never, you know, put together an oral history or done oral history interviews, they think like, oh, okay, so you just strung together some interviews.
No.
And, you know, I have to say, well, you know.
It's a lot more work than you did.
Yeah. It's a lot of work that actually goes into, you know, crafting an oral history that way, because as an interviewer and a person putting together a book like this, you're thinking about what kinds of questions to ask. You're thinking about the themes, and you're thinking about how to kind of bring these stories together in a way and weave them together or knit them together, as Jillian Gilbert and Gani Rietveld talk about using various forms of synth and drum technology to do this kind of reclamation of women's work, but kind of knit them together in this way that really does tell a story.
And it also takes you in a more neutral position in putting this product out. In other words, this is all their voice. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really appreciated about it. It wasn't you trying to make some kind of your theory, your idea about what this is about. This is them talking about it. And it's really interesting about what they have to say about it. Just to give you an example of how important women were, New Order's Blue Monday, which I was just playing before we went on, is the best-selling 12-inch of all time. And the reason that was able to do that, the reason it was able to reach the global audiences was specifically because of certain women who engineered and who did the mailing, who figured out where the records needed to go. They literally were doing the business of Factory Records.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember when I was talking to Leslie Gilbert for this book, who was running the Factory Records office at this point, you know, she talked about the just bonkers situation of getting Blue Monday out, working with all the distributors, thinking about how to ensure enough copies were pressed, enough labels were made, enough sleeves were made. And, you know, without Leslie Gilbert, all those people who bought the Blue Monday 12-inch probably wouldn't have had it, because it wouldn't have gotten out to all those people and all those record stores in really a lot of different parts of the world.
In almost every case, women seemed to be eager to tell their part of the story. Is that true?
You know, I think it comes across that way in the book, but really interestingly, a lot of the women I spoke with did have to be coaxed a little bit. And I'll tell you why. It's part of this problem of the definitive history that I was speaking about. A number of the women I approached initially said something along the lines of what I'm about to say to me. You know, so-and-so and so-and-so wrote these Factory Records books, but they didn't ask me to speak, so I think my story must not be very important.
Oh, wow.
And wow. As soon as I started hearing this, I knew it was really critical to get their voices in the book. But I also, you know, really then understood firsthand the true harm of that idea of the definitive history. Right. It was something I'd thought about theoretically, you know, before, but it really, you know, those moments really drove home to me just how problematic that idea of the definitive history is, because it does really suggest that if you're not included in something like that, oh, you're not important. So for all of those women, I really dug in, and, you know, I gave them my sort of spiel on the definitive history that I gave you just a few minutes ago, and convinced, you know, every single one of the women who had those kinds of reservations to speak for the book. So all of their stories are included.
You also list a few people that you weren't able to get for the book that you really wanted to. I just wanted to ask you about one of them. I'm trying to remember. It was Tina Weymouth.
Oh, yeah.
Now it's the Tina Weymouth from the Talking Heads?
Yeah. Yeah. She produced the Happy Mondays.
That's amazing. I never knew that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. She's a producer and had, I think, an absolutely bonkers time doing that production work.
No kidding.
Yeah, I got a note to her, but she didn't come back. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to speak with her for the book, but she's also long been an idol of mine.
It's amazing when you look at these women, they often never did just one thing. They often did a bunch of things in order to make everything run. Jillian Gilbert of New Order is a good example. She's obviously a musician in New Order, but she co-owned the Hacienda and she was a producer.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that idea of women wearing all these hats, I mean, it's something that is actually pretty common, but something that women don't always get credit for. And thinking about just all these different roles they have to play. And for a lot of women, especially in the 80s, working at the Hacienda, I think the role of mother also came in there and just resulted in all kinds of experiences that a lot of the men couldn't have even imagined. One of the women I spoke with for the book talked to me about having to go home from shifts at the Hacienda to breastfeed when she had kids at home, and then going back and forth. And so just in addition to all these other, you know, professional roles they play, they were also doing this, you know, triple, quadruple, quintuple duty of domestic, you know, domestic duty too.
How would you describe, after talking to these women, in general, how the relationship with them and Tony Wilson in Factory Records? I mean, in general, was it a good relationship or was it bad?
I think women had a really mixed experiences with Tony Wilson. Some of the women absolutely loved Tony and remembered him in ways that were really positive, remembered him as really giving them an opportunity to become creative people themselves and to play important roles in Factory. And other women had, you know, more negative experiences of Tony and remembered him in a really different light. So I think it was really mixed, the experiences the women had with him. I'll say in terms of the experiences the women had with Rob Gretton, it seems to be just absolutely positive all around. There's a moment in the book where I, you know, brought together a bunch of women just remembering Rob, and none of that was actually prompted by me. A lot of them just brought Rob up individually, recalling just what a positive force he was for them, even though he didn't really have a background in thinking about like feminist theory or, you know, ways of sort of resisting like the sociocultural aspects of misogyny in the North. In the day, he really did that in various ways on his own.
It's amazing. Sometimes in the running of Factory Records, it often seemed like the women were the voice of reason.
Absolutely.
When Tony Wilson and the gang were being sort of nuts, like not having contracts with these bands was a classic example. I think it was Tina Simmons who warned Tony about the problem with the new bands. They don't have contracts. And, you know, he thought it was oh so cool that he didn't do that. And then you sort of look at them and these women are like, wow. It's
like, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think first, absolutely, Tina Simmons, like you were saying, Tina talks about running through with Tony and some of the other people at Factory how they were going to go bankrupt if they didn't start attending to their finances in a particular way. And she really, you know, detailedly laid out what was going to happen if they didn't, you know, change their ways. And lo and behold, they went bankrupt. But then I think also Penny Henry at the Hacienda early days. I mean, just absolutely unreal talking to her and, you know, hearing from her about how when she came into the club before it ever opened and said, you know, there's no handrail going down.
Also, wasn't she the one that said there's no coat room either?
Yes, there's no coat room. What are you going to do? Where are people going to put their coats? And she actually talked to me about having to climb up onto the roof of the Hacienda because it was leaking to replace roof slats. I mean, they weren't even thinking about things like this. These practicalities, I mean, are so critical. And, you know, yeah, they're often not maybe the so-called sexy thing.
Yeah, but it's the reason that it's the reason the club existed.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Audrey Golden, station manager, writer, and host of the weekly show Breaking Glass. We're talking about her great new book, I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women at Factory Records. And by the way, the title comes from lyrics to Blue Monday.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. It's also, of course, a double entendre.
I know. Now, there's so many other histories that are in this book, including there are bands that the women were in the people in the States may not be that familiar with, like the Stockholm Monsters, Meow, Section 25, Kalima, The Wake. So there was a whole other sort of culture of women in rock bands on the stage that was going on at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's incredible how many women were actually in the bands. And interestingly, you know, when I was talking to some people about working on this book, not the women in the book, but, you know, just, you know, speaking with friends, other Factory Records fans, they'd said to me, well, there can't be much about the music because there weren't a lot of women in the band. And I've had to, you know, kind of go back and say, well, actually, you know, women were not only fronting a lot of these bands, but had founded a lot of these bands, were, you know, some of the only classically trained people in the band, teaching other members to how to write music, how to kind of, you know, work instruments, especially in the case of Stockholm Monsters. So, yeah, I mean, women just across the board in the Factory bands. And I think, interestingly, their stories haven't been known really until this point either.
The Hacienda was an amazing club when it was functioning. What was the Gay Trader?
The Gay Trader was a bar in the Hacienda that served various cocktails, sort of special cocktails that were themed in various ways, sort of around the same cultural, literary references that also made up a lot of the performances early on in the Hacienda.
Now, there are so many, and you have little details on different sort of events and then happenings that happen, because it was a lot more than music that happened at the Hacienda, too, and you should talk about that, because the women were involved in that. It wasn't just music. It was all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah, I think that's such a critical history of the Hacienda that gets left out in ways that are really shocking to me, actually. So many of the women who worked and became creative forces at the Hacienda talked about how it was so much more than music. It was a place for fashion shows. So the Hacienda sparked a number of women's careers in fashion and design, which is just absolutely incredible. It was a space for dramatic performance. It was a space for art installation. It was a space where visual art could be shown. It was a space for culinary arts and culinary art practices, also by women, by the way, who were, you know, honing arts and crafts as chefs. So it was just this incredible space where women just engaged in so many creative endeavors, and I think really learned to be creative forces themselves in ways that they might not have been able to, but for that, you know, open and inclusive space of the Hacienda when it wasn't taking on the Acid House vibe. I almost said Madhouse, Freudian slip.
I think one of the most important things is for Manchester, for Northern England, it became a queer sanctuary.
Absolutely.
And that's a story that doesn't get told a lot at all.
Absolutely. And I think that, again, is one of the really, you know, prominently missing stories. It absolutely became a welcoming queer space and a queer sanctuary for club goers in a city and kind of region of the country that wasn't always so welcoming and inclusive. And that was thanks in large part to a number of women who made that happen.
That's
to
right.
Lucy Scher, who has since passed away, but organized the Summer of Lesbian Love in 1990, thanks to DJ Michelle Mangan, who came and DJed the Summer of Lesbian Love and brought, as she told me for the book, hundreds of lesbians into the Hacienda in a way that they never dreamed possible.
I know, there are great stories in your book. I think there were 900 lesbians at the Hacienda that day. And for Northern England, that's like a sanctuary. That's like an event you never thought you would ever, ever, ever see. So for queer women, that was a huge event in that area.
Absolutely. And it actually continued as Flesh Night for a number of years with DJ Paulette DJing and helping to, you know, keep that really inclusive and welcoming queer space for women and other club goers who wanted to have a space to dance, who wanted to have a space to be themselves. And interestingly, the Hacienda was that, and it's so important.
Let's talk about DJ Paulette. I just fell in love with her because she seemed so on the money and energetic. She was like everything a DJ needed to be. And a lot of people don't realize that there were many female DJs at the Hacienda. She was an amazing. Talk to me about her, because she was incredible. And there's a great photograph of her in the book, too.
Yeah, yeah. It's a photo by Peter Walsh, who did a lot of great photos of the Hacienda back in the day. But yeah, DJ Paulette was absolutely incredible. I mean, in addition to the Flesh Nights, you know, I think she became such a force in the Hacienda and really hasn't been recognized for that work, although she has come to be recognized as an amazing DJ across the UK, across Europe, across the globe, really. And I think it introduced a lot of people at the Hacienda to music and a kind of sense of atmosphere and inclusive space they wouldn't have had otherwise. And I think what's so amazing about DJ Paulette is the way she is such an amazing and thoughtful thinker as well about the ways that histories get written and the way people like her and other, you know, DJs get written out of the story. This is a quick plug for DJ Paulette. Actually has a memoir that just came out on Manchester University Press.
You
can also pick that up. Yeah.
I definitely want to, because, I mean, her story and her talking about the nights really made it vivid. She was great. And who doesn't like a really great DJ? I mean, they go through hours. They don't take bathroom and food breaks, and they're just doing the music. Now, there's so many incredible people, but I want to just talk about a couple before we run out of time. Yasmin, the first woman doorman in England.
I know. Yes. Unreal. When I learned about her, I discovered, unfortunately, that she had passed away in 2011. So I wasn't able to actually speak with her for the book. But not only did almost every woman who worked at the Hacienda or, you know, had gone to the Hacienda have memories of her, but I was also able to speak with her sister, Soraya, who was her caregiver at the end of her life. And so I was able to, I think, really bring to life Yasmin's story in a way that it had never been brought to life before. What an incredible figure, someone who I think everybody remembered as a really compassionate force, but also a really powerful force who was able to contend with kind of just all the nonsense, you know, that went on in a club. And the first of her kind, she took on this revolutionary role. How is her name not kind of everywhere, all over club histories in the UK?
And an event I want to talk about, 5th of November, 1982, Linda Sterling from the band Ludus in her meat dress, which seemed to cause everybody a tremendous amount of upset. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So this happened, you know, it was one of the early nights of the Hacienda shortly after it had opened. And it was largely in response to the showing of what Linda believed to be misogynist pornography in the Hacienda and sort of among the laddish, I'm using a northern word, they're seen around the club. And so she worked with a number of women, including Liz Naylor and Kath Carroll, who are PR and musicians extraordinaire in their own right, who were managing her at the time, to create a meat dress made of raw meat, all raw meat, so chicken feet, offal, all kinds, intestines, all kinds of other materials, meat materials.
Were tampons used on that?
Yes, and bloody tampons were earrings.
Excellent.
You know, made bloody with the meat. And so she wore this dress on stage to participate, but at the end tore off the skirt and also had a 12-inch dildo underneath the meat skirt as a way of protesting. And to me, it's such an homage to Linda Benglis, the artist who posed in a similar fashion a handful of years earlier in Art Forum, I believe. But then also, I think, gave way to sort of made it possible for a woman like Lady Gaga to also, make a statement with meat.
That's exactly true. I mean, I saw the relationship between the stuff. When everything sort of closed down, what happened to many of the key women? Jillian Gilbert is still playing in New Order.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, Jillian's still in New Order. A lot of the other bands kind of disbanded. after Factory went bust. Some of the women remained in music. Some of them remained doing PR, doing management, doing other design work, filmmaking. But then a number of them actually were really frustrated with the way things had gone down and kind of how they hadn't been listened to, I guess, toward the end of Factory, and got out of the business entirely. So yeah, it's a mixed bag as well.
Well, there'll never be another club like Hacienda.
No.
Well, and it was ahead of its time because of the women that were involved in every aspect of the running of the Hacienda. I mean, just the fact that it had the Lesbian Summer of Love, it had all these great DJs. There's never going to be another club like that that was that radical at that time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it really was. And the way it had so many lives and took on so many different roles in Manchester, too, I think it was a really, really unique space.
Are any of the women celebrated with a plaque or anything in Manchester?
No, but I've got to get on that. I've got to start.
I was going to say
blue plaque people. Yeah.
Well, you know, I can't believe that Yasmin shouldn't have a plaque somewhere, and then DJ Paulette, and certainly a bunch of the other people that worked in Factory Records. Penny Henry, Leslie Gilbert, Lindsay Reed, all of those people that are throughout your book, they all need plaques. I mean, there's plaques about a dozen other things in the area. Why not have some plaques to celebrate the women?
I know, absolutely. You know, I'm going to get on that.
Well, if you make any success, please let me know.
Yes.
We're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been Audrey Golden, station manager, writer, and host of the weekly show Breaking Glass. And we're talking about her new book. It's a book that totally blew my mind. I Thought I Heard You Speak, Women at Factory Records. Audrey, thank you so much for getting this book together.
Thanks so much for reading, and thanks so much for having me on the show.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.